Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the Voice of the Millennials with myself, Yasin Kipi. The topic today is regarding the political and media landscape in South Africa, especially in the run-up to the 6th democratic elections that will be taking place in May. And I think it's important also to understand the political economy behind that. What does that exactly mean? Why do people vote the way they do? Why are you going to vote for the ANC or the EFF or the DA or perhaps a Muslim party that is running in the elections? Why will you vote for them? In order to uncover the truth behind all of these questions, you need to ask the right questions in the first place. My guest today is someone who asks the right questions, and she's of course well known in the political journalistic scene. That's Qanita Hunter, who's a senior political reporter, senior by merit and not by age, and I must say that for a number of media houses in South Africa, including EWN, Eyewitness News, The Sunday Times, Mail and Guardian, and believe it or not, she used to work for The New Age, of course. We'll ask her about that a little bit later. Her political and investigative reporting has won her many awards. She's also the author of the 2015 Diary of a Guji Girl, a fictional story of a young South African Muslim woman in her first year at university. Most recently, she's come to light in the news for her coverage of President Cyril Ramaphosa and some other controversial meetings, of course, the Maharani meeting particularly. Assalamu alaikum to you, Qanita. Shukran for joining us.
Wa alaikum salam. Thank you very much for having me.
So that's a big resume, but where did it all start? Tell us about your journey in journalism.
In 2011, I was 17 years old. I'd finished matric. I decided that I wanted to be a journalist. And I always wanted to be a journalist. It was always something that I wanted to do. Other people spent their money on going to the movies. I bought newspapers and books. That was just my life. I always tell the story about pink sparkly shoes. And people look at me like I'm a mad person. But I remember at the time, I had this pink sparkly shoes that I still wear all the time. And I decided to pack my bags and go to Joburg and try to be a journalist. And I didn't take any other shoes besides those pink sparkly shoes because they were my favorite. And I had a bag of clothes and I had a bag of books. And that's it. And I got onto a bus. And then I arrived at Johannesburg Park Station, which is quite notorious. I was sort of so sold onto my dream that I didn't realize that they cut my bag and stole my wallet, right? So there I was in Johannesburg with 200 rand and then having to have gone and sort of literally begged, at the time it was Channel Islam, for a job. Literally, I don't think I even had my matric certificate yet. Mm-hmm. I don't think I had my results out yet. Had to beg them for a job, because I wanted to be a journalist, and I was like, I'm prepared to work for free. And then since then, you know, I started off in that space where you obviously do a bit of news, and then I would, you know, venture in to do some reporting. And what I had to do at the time was I had to sort of juggle my work. What I was employed to do was, you know, producing shows and compiling bulletins, etc., with actual reporting. So that I had to do after hours, yes, so that I was able to get exposure. And I remember I would like sort of meet random people on the streets, journalists and people who are not my friends, and I'll be like, okay, teach me how to do this. You know, I don't know how to do this. And I was fascinated by it. Obviously, being someone who's been very involved or rather aware of the news and current affairs and sort of believing that South African media or media in general has a very important role to play in a democracy. And then I sort of went on from there and you know, got many other career opportunities. That's the word, opportunities. So basically after Channel Islam, my resume is not that long. I'm not that old, but I worked for The New Age. I did some television for ANN7. I then worked for The Mail and Guardian, which is where The Mail and Guardian, where I really learned how to do serious political and investigative reporting, which was an incredible experience for me. Then I went on to the Sunday Times. But I obviously did a lot of work for your Al Jazeera and TRT and your international broadcasters, which was a really, really good experience. But the heart of what I do is I tell stories about things you don't already see on TV.
Would you say that you had a specific or a certain knack for writing or reading? Because like you said, you where you are now is based on experience. You never went through the conventional, you know, study journalism and then go...
I mean, I had to study journalism. Okay. I had to do it part-time. Yeah. That was something I just had to do.
Yeah.
And I graduated from Wits University. Yeah. But that was sort of a secondary thing. So when people ask me, were you always good at writing? I was never good at writing. And I don't think I'm good at writing. Okay. And that's the funny thing about my story was... And you know when you meet people that you're in school with or... and they're like, but you were not a good writer. And I'm like, but it doesn't matter. If you are passionate about something, if yeah. you put in the hours... And that's the difference between people who have big dreams and people who are actual... doers.
Yeah.
You don't really have to be great at something. You just have to keep working on it. Mm-hmm. And I saw that with my own life. You know, and this is not in no way me trying to do a small humble brag here, but I was really not good at writing.
Yeah.
And it was something that I had to identify very early on that I am not naturally good at this. Therefore, I have to learn and keep learning and keep getting better at it.
Okay. I think that's an important thing that I just wanted to bring up.
Yeah, I think, but also the fact that is, you know, in order to be a good journalist, it's not a 9-to-5 job, and you can't expect it, even if you have a natural ability to write good, isn't it? So, I think that's an important thing to note. But telling stories as the lens,
yeah,
you know, and of course that led you to write your first book as well. Tell us about how that came about.
So it's a weird thing, you know. People have these remarkable stories about. I was so inspired. I was sitting by the ocean and a story popped into my mind that there was absolutely no such thing in my life. I was working at the New Age at the time. I was young. I was 19 years old. I was working at the New Age at the time. I was doing politics, you know, on a very low salary, mind you. And I had a very long commute to work in the morning. And one of the very, you know, big things that I did initially in my career was I bought myself a little iPad. Mm-hmm. And so what I would do is that my long commute to work every day, I would sit and I would write this fictional story that I completely made up. And it was just a means of coping or just dealing with my day. And so when I got to work, so my brain is sort of thinking about Amina and her character and Mo. And I mean, it's a chick-lit story about a girl and her experiences at university, which I've never actually been to university at that time, or at least been full-time at university. But it was something that you know, was sort of a therapy session for me that somehow eventually was published into a book. But my focus has always been, and that was something about me, was that sort of I was so steadfast on that I need to focus on my career, I need to focus on journalism, I need to focus on, especially when you kind of, you know, when you start on a back foot, because now you're trying to compete with people who've been around in the game for 10 years.
Yes.
You have to prove yourself to editors who hired you with no qualification. I literally qualified. Mm-hmm. I was working for 7 years and then I got a degree. You understand?
Yes, yes.
So it was in that way. It was not an easy feat for me to do. And I mean the normal challenges of life and whatever that comes along. You know, trying to make it in an industry, especially at a young age. So this was sort of like an alternative for me. I also didn't have a life. and I mean, a lot of people, you know, would sit back and be like, oh, you know, you've done well and you've won awards. And, you know, for 4 years of my life, I slept on the floor. Like, I rented a place and I couldn't afford to buy a bed, so I didn't buy a bed. You know, and I traveled the world. You know, I mean, don't feel sorry for me. I traveled the world. But you understand what I'm saying? It's those kind of... For me, now when I look back... In a place where I've finally got to a place where I'm sort of comfortable, and it's always something that I've always was reaching to, and now I need to create new goals and new aspirations for myself. I look back and I say, you know, yes, you didn't have it easy, but at the same time, I think it's a privilege to have had the opportunities that I've had. And working hard has never killed anyone, and I've survived to tell the tale. You know, there were times where I had to hustle two or three jobs at a time, and the world didn't end. The world really didn't end. And the biggest thing for me was, and I say this and not many people get it, but it's something that I live by, is that it's very easy to be a huge fish in a small little pond. So you can be relevant, making a difference in a small little room. But when you try to make a difference in a bigger hall, it's harder to do. Mm-hmm. And that's where it matters most. And that was always my, that was always what pushed me. That's always what motivated me. Was not really, it really wasn't about, you know, creating a name for yourself. That was all byproducts. For me, what the most important thing was that you can play in a space, you can swim in the ocean and not drown.
So, you say that you've been through this, you know, experience working very hard, and it doesn't kill you, of course, physically, but there's a lot of emphasis these days on mental health. Surely there must have been a strain mentally working so hard, isn't it?
So you raise a really valid point, right? And I mean, this sort of gets a bit too personal than where I'm comfortable with, but mental health is a serious thing. And I was reading an article in the New York Times the other day about burnout culture and the, yes. and the emphasis on hustling all the time.
Yeah.
Without having a minute to rejuvenate and just to rejuvenate and to sort of make sure that you're doing well in other aspects of your life. And there's a book by Shonda Rhimes where she says that when I'm excelling at one part of my life, be rest assured that I am failing in 50 other parts of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something I had to grapple with, because when my career was on track, my personal life wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
When my personal life was... So it's this kind of extremes that you sort of flirt between.
Yeah.
And I think young professionals face this all the time, where it's a matter of you really want to be good at your job and you really want to make a difference, but at the same time, you really want to have a good family life or a healthy mental state. And it becomes an either-or situation, which I think we really, really need to redefine how we look at success and how we look at life.
Yes.
In a way that we are not killing ourselves, but at the same time, we are doing more than the next person in trying to make a difference.
This is easier said than done. Have you overcome that difficulty in balancing things yet?
So 2019 is my year. Is my year to try that out. So I mean, like I said, for the first time in my career, in my more than 8 years now, almost 9 years, I feel like I'm in a place where, you know, I've worked hard, I've put in the effort, and now it's a matter of just sort of building on that.
Mm-hmm.
But for me now, as a human being, and especially as a Muslim, the most important thing for me now is to create that balance where we are, when we walk in a room, we are some of our total experiences. We are not our careers, we are not our families, we are not our bank balances. We're not, and to get that equilibrium is something that you constantly work on, especially in a career that's so demanding and so volatile. Really, the political space has been a roller coaster for the last 5 years,
yes,
if not longer, to the point now where, you know, President Cyril Ramaphosa is now the president. Things are not as hectic as it was under former President Jacob Zuma. If you just take the State of the Nation address, for example, it's not normal to be sort of geared up and ready for some action, long nights and drama and craziness. But that's what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And for me now, I'm in a space where I'm thinking about, okay, what's important to me? What do I want to do? How do I want to tell stories? Because the medium really doesn't matter. We can tell stories in different... And now the time is perfectly right to tell stories through many mediums at the same time.
Yes.
And it's just about getting that right and informing people and telling people why things are happening. That's for me what's my biggest motivator of why I write the stories that I do. It's not about telling people what they can already see on television or here on radio. It's about explaining to them why that matters.
Yes, that's absolutely profound, because I mean, so many people are trying to decide or trying to figure out statistically why, you know, we should advertise on Facebook rather than Instagram, or you know, on television rather than radio, all of these different questions. But like you say, it's not the medium that's the main factor, it's actually how you present it, or at least, you know, the message behind that. And that's, it's interesting, because you are in print media, which is seen quote unquote as a dying form of media.
So the thing is about print media is that it is limping around, right? And people have been predicting the death of print about newspapers for a very long time, and it's true. People don't buy newspapers anymore as much as they used to. But the reality is that the type of journalism that exists in the print space, especially in the Sunday space, is a type that we need for democracy. Yeah. And it's a thing that broadcast hasn't gone to that level yet. Mm. We, again, like I said, and maybe I sound like a broken record, but explaining the why, the what. Let me give you an example. Mm-hmm. At the State of the Nation address, Ramaphosa made two big announcements. He made an announcement that there would be a new directorate in the National Prosecuting Authority to prosecute and investigate state capture-related crimes.
Yeah.
He also announced the unbundling of Eskom into three entities.
Yes.
So people reported on that. People said, President Cyril Ramaphosa announced A, B, and C. Mm-hmm. Now, a simple question is, okay, this directorate, everyone assumed that it's going to be what the old Scorpions is. Mm-hmm. But in his address, he says it will be in line of sections, and I know this sounds, you know, boring and you know, a long winding road, but it'll get somewhere quite soon. But so basically, Ramaphosa says, okay, in line with Section 7 of the NPA Act, we're appointing this directorate, and everyone screams, the Scorpions are back, people are going to be investigated. Yes. All you need to do is go to some website and
the
say,
NPA, right?
And you get to the NPA Act and you say, okay, what is this? What is the veracity of the Act? Then you realize, okay, the Act is temporary. I mean, this directorate rather,
yes.
It would be temporary. It would be in line with. So basically, they're not going to be able to just investigate all crimes. They will have to investigate crimes that are specifically, you know, proclaimed by the president.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So now this directorate is going to be set up. What do you need to do? Who's going to be funding this directorate? Mm. You then go to the Justice Minister. The Justice Minister says, sorry, we have no money for it. Mm-hmm. So can you understand the depth in which, and the reason why we do our jobs? It's not a matter of breaking news, which, yeah. I mean, it really has its place in society. Yeah. But it's a matter of, and that has always been my motivator, so going backwards and understanding, okay, cool, you said this directorate is going to be in, when is it going to come? Okay, fine. Now the finance minister is saying, okay, he needs money from treasury, he's scraping at the bottom of the barrel, there's no money for this directorate to prosecute and investigate state capture, which is a huge problem, that so many people have been implicated in serious crimes and no one has gone to jail. Later on got to jail, there's no one on trial for state capture in the country at the moment. So the interesting thing is, once you start lifting and you start probing questions, then you have the Treasury Director General saying, we can't give them money right now for it, we'll have to only give them in October. Which begs the question, will this directorate only be established in October? So this is just a sort of a long example of why it's important, and why when politicians talk, their word needs to be scrutinized, and it's not always a true reflection of what is happening behind the scenes.
Now, the thing about language, and in South Africa especially, English is, it's not the first, you know, most commonly spoke language. I think it might be fourth or fifth in the country. Of course, Zulu is number one, but when politicians speak in English, you know, English is the language of the professional sector, a lot of people interpret the way they speak through an English which is not their first language. Should we judge them by how they express themselves so strictly when they speak in English compared to when they would speak in Zulu, because one of the things about Jacob Zuma, he was often mocked about how he used to speak slowly and how he used to count numbers, but he's a great orator in Zulu itself.
Yeah, so I mean, my advantage is that I understand and speak Zulu very well. Okay, I don't speak, but I understand very well. But which helped me a lot when you're covering politics in the, you know, in your sort of rural areas and KZN, etc. But I hear what you're saying. I think that it's fickle to judge politicians in the way that they talk. Mm. And I think in Africa, that's a huge problem across the continent. I was reading a book by a colleague of mine, Ray Ndlovu, where he wrote about the transition that happened in Zimbabwe, which, you know, Robert Mugabe to Emmerson Mnangagwa. Mm. And he speaks about how Mugabe being a better orator, really, a much better orator than Mnangagwa, but Mnangagwa has the wit. And so the reality is you cannot judge politicians based on the way they talk, not in South Africa, really. It's something that I think the middle class really needs to understand and to grapple, because there was this meme going around that, you know, where a guy was sort of mocking the grammar of a black South African, and someone responds to him and says, can you translate something? He gave a phrase and like, can you translate this, you know? Yeah. And so I think the way we judge politicians need to be a lot more in substance. Yeah. And I think for a long time, people sort of, there was this homophobia, particularly just on appearance, not really on substance about them. I mean, yes, there may probably be things that, you know, excites people about the new president, but we have to engage further. We have to take the conversation further. We have to engage on policies and engage on ideas and engage on outlooks of these politicians to understand them beyond the rhetoric and the fancy tones. And
it's really language. Insightful getting this, you know, for a deeper reasoning from the way you make decisions. And it's an important question because we have been facing so many different commissions over the years. You know, the TRC itself is coming back into the light of whether, you know, we gave up justice for the sake of peace. You know, is that valid? And of course, now the Zondo Commission, all of these things creates an atmosphere of decision making that we have to make with regards to media ethics itself. Why do we cover certain stories?
Yeah.
And of course, you covered a very interesting story last year about the Maharani meeting. Tell us about that decision making behind when it comes to these controversial topics in the South African media landscape.
So I mean, I covered many big stories. That story became popular and trended a little bit because of the sort of the secrecy behind it, and also because I received death threats as a result of it, right? At the moment, the media landscape is quite polluted, and that's as a result of many things. The first of which is a concerted effort by politicians or people in the elite or in positions of power to pollute the space, and so disinformation is a reality. Then there's the real phenomenon of fake news, where disinformation, lies, and misinformation, which are very different things, are deliberately packaged and sort of purported in the name of news, but it's actually false. So fabrications.
I mean, I understand you saying that, but do you have any proof for saying that?
Yeah, so there's a lot of studies done on bots, where we know that there's a research on the Gupta, the Gupta's used Bell Pottinger, which is was a sort of a public relations company to manufacture wrong information. I was a victim of that myself. After the Maharani meeting, there's a story on African News 24/7, which is a fake news website, really, anonymous, and just a lot of misrepresentations and lies. There's a story about me and my apparent very cozy relationship with the Guptas and my history. Apparently, I had asked them for an editor position. Imagine at 19 years old, I asked someone for an editor position. And that is why I am now vindictive against them. And so they're exposing me. And I mean, that, it's all fabrications. If you see what happens on Twitter, you know, when you write stories about the EFF now, and that's a massive issue. It's so bad, the situation, that the Independent Electoral Commission, the IEC, has is revising the electoral code of conduct that will make it a punishable offense for a political party to spread fake news.
Yes.
So I mean, this is the space that we're working in. Then we're also working in a space where legitimate coverage of stories are labeled fake news by politicians stemming from Donald Trump, really.
Yes.
And so it's easy now to get away with not being held accountable because you can say, that's fake news, I don't want to speak. And then there's also the issue of legitimate mistakes made by media companies, and Sunday Times are excluded from that. Mm-hmm. Which then muddies the space for legitimate and serious stories that come afterwards.
Yes.
And then obviously it's a space, there's the issue of just, you know, commercial interests playing in that media space. So there's all of these challenges with regard to the media space at the moment. And then we heard from the Zondo Commission that some journalists were being bribed, and there was a whole lot of outcry about that. Now, the reality about a democracy is that there will always be a push and pull between journalists and the people in power. It has to happen. We have to pull and they have to push back. We have to pull and they have to push back. It's the way the world works. But the most important thing that we have to bear in mind at the moment is, as journalists, we have to be as accurate as possible. And therefore, when you're reporting about a secret meeting with possibly with some of the most powerful people in the country, you have to be on the money and you have to be 100% sure of your facts and your information. Now, do journalists get things wrong? Yes, we do get things wrong. It happens all the time. The reality is now, the appetite for journalists to get things wrong is no longer there. We can't afford it, especially with this type of level of attack on journalists coming from different quarters. At the moment, we're feeling it the most from the EFF, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But tomorrow you write a story about the DA, and the DA starts attacking journalists. And I mean, it's been a good run for Ramaphosa because, you know, he hasn't had what many would call a serious negative press. But that's because, you know, he's still finding his feet, etc. I mean,
well, that's him personally, but the ANC definitely has, including absolutely. Stella Abrams and Ndebele Abrams.
And I mean, if you look at that Stella and Ndebele Abrams story, right? She was given the benefit of the doubt. She was the deputy minister to Faith Mutambi.
Yes.
And Faith Mutambi, as communications minister, got an SABC journalist fired for asking her a tough political question, right? Yeah. So Stella Ndebele Abrams gets appointed, everyone's excited, and then Stella Ndebele Abrams goes to a rally, and then sort of literally, this SABC is her... directly reports to her. She's the main shareholder as a minister of communications in the SABC, and she physically restricts the SABC from doing their job because a politician was being heckled and booed. So I mean, we have a long way to go in this country. There are issues of, you know, the state. I mean, we can sit here and lament forever, but I think our role, and especially I tell this to other young journalists, our role is not to be glamorous. Our role is not to be wear shiny suits and be on TV. Our role is to sit and analyze things and to inform people in a way that it makes them understand why we're telling them what we're telling them.
But why do you do that then?
Because what difference does it make to you that there's going to be a directorate in the NPA investigating state capture? In your life,
only in the long term, I suppose.
But that's why it's our job to explain to you that for the last 8 years, there's been hundreds of cases of state capture, and there's been no serious investigation. Uh-huh. And the fact that commercial crimes, for example, is not being prosecuted in South Africa, and by commercial crimes, I mean corruption, state capture, blah, 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 it then breaks it down to the old lady that's sitting in Athlone to understand why her son's killers were not put behind bars.
Yes.
You understand? So everything that happens on the top layer, this top structure, politics doesn't take place in a little bubble on its own. And that, for me, was something I had to learn very quickly. And I had to understand that it really isn't about, you know, politicians and about Julius. It's about how that what happens in the top impacts all the way down.
Yeah, it's really about the accountability mechanisms. In fact, you'll be having a upcoming podcast looking at the criminal justice system, am I right?
Yeah, so I'm working on a project that basically unpacks the criminal justice system, understanding why is it that when you hear the State Capture Commission, I'm using that as a really, really silly example, but there's been so many violations of the law. Let's talk about the big things, like the money laundering, that's harder to prove. But just the basic violation of the Poker Act, for example, that can get you 5 years in jail. No one has been arrested. And if they have been arrested, like Duduzane Zuma is now out, the Guptas are no longer
In South Africa, yeah.
Yeah, not only in South Africa, but they're not on trial anymore. Okay. So those cases have all been bungled. And to understand how that has an impact on an ordinary person, which is why when you report a crime, even if it could be a petty crime, people just are despondent and don't understand why things are not happening and people aren't getting arrested. And so all of these things have ripple effects. The reality is, when you look at politics, you look at political reporting, a fish rots from the head. And so when the top tier of our politics is so muddied and really rotten, it filters down into the lives of ordinary people, which is why people in the Free State may not be having houses, or their foundations for their houses were built, but the rest of the money was stolen. Yeah. Which is why you have load shedding. Which is why you understand. So yeah. All of
even
these
even
things.
Issues in District 6, you know, might relate to.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so it's a matter of just it's a matter of caring and understanding that there is a bigger picture, and everything is actually interconnected.
Mm-hmm. Now. Looking at the most important, you know, elections that will be happening this year, of course, the national elections, and you covering that, is it possible for a journalist to, you know, personally align to a political party while covering any of the news in South Africa?
So, I mean, we've obviously had lots of long discussions about this. I think that there's no place for a journalist to be active in politics. There's no place for a journalist to be active in politics. I think our activism should be, and as pretentious as this may sound, should be for the people. And so, yes, you may have a political leaning as a human being. You would have a political leaning. That is something that will always be there because we are human beings. And besides political bias that you'd come into a situation, you have, you know, middle class bias, for example, mm-hmm. or you'd have racial bias. Mm-hmm. All of these things, but the matter, the fact of the matter is that the impartiality or objectivity is the problem. So you can be an ardent. Good. Is Patricia Dillon's party good? Good.
Yes, yeah. Good,
you can be an ardent good supporter or an ardent, what is it, ATM supporter. but I mean, you can objectively tell a story about the ANC. I don't think we're in that space, and I don't think that, I think there's too many checks and balances in place for journalists to go and punt, for a political party. The bigger problem is not really about the parties, it's about individuals, about personalities. Yeah. South African media space is not too much about structures and parties as it is about politicians and popular people. And there's been a lot of, you know, factionalism as it is in the political space. And so finding yourself navigating through that, you know, in a way that's impartial and objective is can be more difficult than expected, but it's absolutely important.
Absolutely. And just my final question with regards to young journalists or young people who are aspiring to become journalists, what do you think the future holds when it comes to the trade itself? In terms of, you know, just the standard of living for journalists, there's been so much talk about, you know, journalism itself being replaced just by social media. People can just put things out on social media. And so the trade itself, what's your perspective on that?
So it was interesting watching the State of the Nation, which I saw you there, where I saw a stunning number of young people on at State of the Nation, people of all colors, of all sizes and ages. And for me, that was really, really inspiring, because when I started off and I came to my first State of the Nation, it didn't look the way it did now. Uh-huh. And I think the democratization of the space is an amazing thing. And I think that as young reporters, my only advice would be is that try as many things as possible. Try things, take risks, and also be as versatile as possible. You cannot only be a print reporter. You have to be able to produce a podcast and capture sound and capture. And the world is changing, and don't be afraid of change. And once you realize that, and once you've gotten past that, then you can then focus on the stories that you want to tell. Not everyone wants to tell a political story. People want to tell, you know, stories about how steel drums in Zimbabwe are being turned into furniture, and those are brilliant stories as well. It's a matter of being, you know, dedicated and original, but more importantly, being able to learn from the world around you and see how things are done and how things ought to be done. And I think that it's an interesting time for the media at the moment. So it's a difficult time, really. I see it in my short little walk space. It's difficult. It's going to get more difficult, given the way the trajectory that politics is taking in the world. And now is sort of, you know, the most difficult time to be a journalist, but also the most important time.
And do you think it's important also to, you know, overcome the challenges of constantly reporting that which is negative in the country? Because what people really need, do you think, is hope for the future? Well, at the same
time, it's a grim job. It's a grim job, because you end up, you know, telling really, really lackluster, terribly depressing stories, and for the most part, you know, I'm trying to sort of figure out a way to balance it up with those, you know, some hip and happening type of stories as well. It isn't always possible, but it can be daunting, and I think, which is probably the reason why young people don't consume news as our parents did. Mm-hmm. It's because it's just too depressing. And I mean, rightfully so. I don't know how you can't not report on depressing
so
things.
Do you think we need a daily show like Trevor Noah's in America? We need one.
Yeah, we do. I think, you know what we need to do. We need to take the mickey out of the situation. And I think once that happens, then people realize that, you know, maybe perhaps we take politics too seriously. And people's voices are actually what's really more important than anything else. I would love to see even a proper weekly, but a well-researched. So I've been, I don't know if you have, but you've been watching Hasan Minhaj's show on Netflix, Patriot Act.
Yeah.
It is brilliant. And the reason why I thoroughly enjoy his show is for the simple fact that he's not dumbing down on information. People are not stupid. People are quite intelligent. It's a matter of how you present it and explaining to people in a way that's relatable. And it's not, you know, a person sitting on a podium or sitting behind a desk in his perfect suit, in his big English, trying to explain to you why things matter. It's about breaking it down and just telling a story, explaining the world in a very different way. That's kind of where I see myself in the future. I mean, not in that particular space, but in able to do what you're doing, what I'm doing rather, you know, in principle, and just doing it in a different way.
You know. Well, absolutely. Thank you so much. That's Juanita Hunter, our guest, of course. I'm a great privilege to interview you. I'm not sure if I'll be here next year for Sona. But no, there's another Sona in June, of course.
There's another Sona in June, and that will be the then president-elect. Will he be president-elect?
Malema. I'm joking. No, I'm just joking.
And then we'll all sing.
We will all sing, of course, Tuma Amina by Yuma Sekela. Well, thank you so much. Shukran to you. All the best for, of course, you in Cape Town covering the Sona debate as well. And then you're back to Johannesburg. Are you from Johannesburg? Or are you from Gauteng?
I currently live there.
Yeah, but you're not from Gauteng.
I'm originally. Not from Gauteng, no.
Okay. Are you from KwaZulu-Natal?
I'm from all over. So
where did you learn Zulu, though? That's really fascinating.
Because I was a kid in Durban, but I have no family in Durban. We just stayed in Durban.
Okay.
I have a lot of family here. I have a lot of family in Kimberley, the Northern Cape. I have family in a town on the outskirts of Gauteng called Springs. Mm-hmm. So it's always an awkward question. To answer, it's like, where are you from? I'm like, I don't know. I lived in Durban. I now live in Johannesburg.
I mean, where were you born?
I was born in this random town in the KZN Midlands, okay. Like called Ladysmith. I've never actually been there, back there after I was born there. But that's okay. Basically the story of my life.
Shukran so much to you. All the best in the future.
Shukran. Wa alaikum.